but I need not have alarmed myself, for her manner was too ungracious for any such politeness. The visitor's room to which she conducted us seemed to be the worst in the house, being close-smelling, dirty, and narrow. However, we were obliged to put up with it. The rector was clearly not given to ancient hospitality. Before the day was over, I saw we had to do with a blacksmith, a fisherman, a hunter, a carpenter, and not at all with a minister of Christ. True, we came on a weekday. Perhaps he was a better man on Sundays. I don't want to say anything bad of these poor priests, who after all are miserably off. The sum they receive from the Danish government is ridiculously small, and all they have besides is a fourth part of the tithe, which does not amount to more than 60 marks, about £4. Consequently, they are obliged to work for a living. But fishing and hunting and shoeing horses gives a man at last the tone and habits and manners of fishermen and hunters and farriers and such-like people. I found at night that even sobriety could not be reckoned among his virtues. My uncle quickly understood his man. Instead of a good and honourable man of learning, this was a coarse, lumpish peasant. He therefore resolved to commence his great expedition with the least possible delay, and to get out of this inhospitable parsonage. In utter disregard of his fatigues, he determined to go and spend a few days in the mountain. The very next morning our preparations began. Hans hired 3 Icelanders to take the place of the horses and carry our luggage, but it was distinctly understood that as soon as they had deposited it in the crater, they were to turn and go back, and leave us to do the best we could. My uncle took this opportunity of apprising Hans of his intention to explore the volcano to its furthest limits. Hans simply nodded. To go there, or anywhere else, into the bowels of the earth or on the surface, was all alike to him. For myself, hitherto I had been amused by the incidents of the journey, and been somewhat forgetful of the future, but now my terrors returned in full force. But what was to be done? If I wished to resist Professor Liddenbrock, it was at Hamburg I should have done it, and not at Snaefell. One thought especially tormented me, one which might appall stouter nerves than mine. I said to myself, "We are going to ascend Snaefell. That's well enough. We are going to visit the crater. Well enough, too. Others have done that, and they came up alive. But that is not all. If there should actually be a passage into the bowels of the earth, and that unlucky Sack Newsome spoke truth, we shall go and lose ourselves in the subterranean windings of the volcano. But what is there to prove that Snaefell is extinct? Who will guarantee that an eruption is not preparing to break out? Because the monster has been sleeping since 1229, does it follow that he will never wake up again? And if he does wake up, what will become of us?" This was worth thinking about, and I did think about it. I could not sleep without dreaming of eruptions, and I must say I did not feel inclined to play the part of Scoria. At last, I could not bear myself any longer, and resolved to submit the case to my uncle with as much tact as possible, and under the form of an impossible hypothesis. I went in quest of him, and told him my fears, and then drew back to let his first outburst of passion pass over. But all he said was, "I have been thinking of it." What could he mean? Was he really going to listen to the voice of reason? Could he be going to suspend his project? It was too good to be true. After a few minutes' silence, which I did not venture to interrupt, he repeated again, "I was thinking of it. Ever since we arrived here at Stapi, my mind has been occupied with the grave question you have just submitted to me, for it would not do for us to be imprudent." "No, indeed," I said emphatically. "For 600 years, Snaefell has been silent, but he may speak. Still, Eruptions are always preceded by well-known phenomena. I have been, therefore, interrogating the inhabitants of this district on the subject. I have examined the ground, and I am in a position to say there will be no eruption." I was amazed at this declaration, and could make no reply. "Do you doubt what I tell you?" resumed my uncle. "Well, come with me." I obeyed mechanically. The professor took a direct course away from the sun by going through an opening in the basaltic wall. Soon we were in the open country, if the word can apply to an immense heap of volcanic matter. The whole region seemed to have been overwhelmed with a flood of enormous fragments of trap, basalt, granite, and all the pyroxene rocks. Here and there I could see puffs of white vapour rising in the air. These are called by the Icelanders reykir, and issue from thermal springs, which by their violence indicate the volcanic activity of the soil. This seemed to justify my fears, but I fell from the clouds when my uncle went on to say, "You see all this smoke, Axel? Well, they prove that we have nothing to fear from the fury of the volcano." "What an idea!" I exclaimed. "Remember this," continued the professor. "At the approach of an eruption, these vapors redouble their activity, but disappear entirely while the phenomenon lasts, for the electric fluids, being relieved from pressure, escape by the crater instead of finding their way out through the cracks in the ground. Since then, these vapors are now in the usual state, and there is no increase of energy, and also that the wind and rain have not given way to a heavy, dead calm, you may be sure no eruption is at hand. But enough. When science has spoken, it is for us to hold our peace." I went back to the parsonage very crestfallen. My uncle had vanquished me by scientific arguments. One hope, however, still remained, and this was that, on our reaching the bottom of the crater, we should find no passage, in spite of all the sagnusums in the world. I passed the night in all the miseries of nightmare. I was in the midst of a volcano, in the depths of the earth. I felt myself hurled into the planetary spaces in the form of ejected rock. The next day, the 22nd of June, Hans was ready, waiting us, with his companions bearing the provisions, tools, and instruments. Two stout sticks tipped with iron, and two rifles and two shot belts, were reserved for my uncle and myself. Hans, like a wise man, had added to our baggage a leathern bottle filled with water, which, with our gourds, would be a sufficient supply for a week. It was 9 a.m. The rector and his tall shrew stood at the door of the parsonage, doubtless to bid us farewell, but their adieu took the shape of a tremendous bill. They charged us for everything, even to the air we breathed, and that was polluted enough, I can vouch for it. This worthy couple fleeced us like any Swiss hotel keeper, and made us pay a good price for their make-believe hospitality. My uncle settled the account, however, without any higgling. A man who is just about to start for the centre of the earth does not care about a few rix dollars. This matter arranged, Hans gave the signal for starting, and a few minutes afterwards we left Stapi. Chapter 15. Snaefell is 5,000 feet high. Its double cone terminates in a trachytic belt, which stands out from the mountain system of the island. From our starting point, we could not see its two peaks outlined against the grey clouds. I could only see an enormous cap of snow coming down low over the giant's forehead. We walked in file, preceded by the hunter, who was climbing by such narrow paths that two could not go abreast. All conversation was therefore nearly impossible. Beyond the basaltic wall of the fjord at Stapi, the ground was herbaceous, fibrous peat, the remains of the ancient vegetation of the bogs on the peninsula. The quantity of this unworked combustible was enough to warm all the people in Iceland for a century. This vast turf pit measured in certain ravines 70 feet deep, and presented successive layers of carbonized detritus separated by sheets of tufaceous pumice. As a true nephew of Professor Lidenbrock, and notwithstanding my mental preoccupation, I was interested in observing the mineralogical curiosities displayed in this vast cabinet of natural history, and, at the same time, was going over in my mind the whole geological history of Iceland. This most curious island has evidently risen from the depths of the sea at a comparatively recent epoch. Perhaps it may be even still rising by an insensible motion. If that be so, its origin can only be attributed to the action of subterranean fires, and in this case, Humphrey Davy's theory and Sack Newsom's document and my uncle's speculations, too, all vanish in smoke. This hypothesis made me carefully examine the nature of the soil. I could soon account for the successive phenomena which attended its formation. Iceland, being wholly destitute of alluvial soil, is entirely composed of volcanic tufa, that is, a conglomeration of stones and rocks of a porous texture. Prior to the existence of volcanoes, it was composed of trappean rock, slowly upheaved from the sea by the central forces. The interior fires had not yet burst forth. But at a subsequent period, a large fissure appeared running in a diagonal direction from southwest to northeast, by which all the trachyte gradually forced its way out. This phenomenon was not attended with any violence, but the issue was enormous, and the fused matter thrown up from the bowels of the earth spread slowly in vast sheets or rounded protuberances. To this epoch, the feldspars, syenites, and porphyries belong. But thanks to this outflow, the thickness of the island increased considerably, and in consequence, its powers of resistance. It can be imagined what quantities of electric fluids had accumulated within its bosom when no channel of escape presented itself after the trachytic crust had cooled and hardened. There came then a time when the mechanical force of these gases became such that they upheaved the heavy crust and made for themselves tall chimneys. The upheaval of the crust first formed the volcanoes, and then a crater suddenly opened at the summit. To the eruptive phenomena succeeded the volcanic. By the newly created openings, the basaltic ejections first escaped, of which the plain we were crossing presented the most wonderful specimens. We were walking over grey rocks, which had cooled into hexagonal prisms. In the distance, a great number of truncated cones were visible, each of which had formerly been a mouth of fire. After the basaltic eruption, the volcano, which increased in force by the extinction of other craters, made a passage for lavas and for tufa, viz. Ashes and scoria, long streams of which I could see on the mountainsides, hanging down like flowing hair. Such was the succession of phenomena which produced Iceland, all proceeding from the internal fire, and to suppose that the mass within was not still in a state of fusion was folly. And surely to pretend to try and reach the centre of the globe was the very climax of folly. I reassured myself, therefore, about the issue of this enterprise, even while we were on our way to the assault of Snæfell. The route became more and more difficult. The ground was rising. The loose masses of rock trembled, and the utmost care was needed to prevent dangerous falls. Hans walked on as quietly as if he were on level ground. At times he would disappear behind great blocks, and for a moment we lost sight of him. Then a sharp whistle told us the direction in which to follow him. Often, too, he stopped, picked up some fragments of rock, and arranged them in a recognizable manner, making landmarks in this way all along the road to show us the route back. A good precaution on his part, though future events rendered it useless. 3 hours of fatiguing walking had only brought us to the base of the mountain. There Hans made a signal to stop, and a hasty breakfast was shared among us. My uncle took 2 mouthfuls at a time, to dispatch it the quicker. But this halt was not only for breakfast, but for rest, and Hans did not make a start until 1 hour had elapsed. The 3 Icelanders, as taciturn as their comrade, never uttered a syllable, and munched away with solemn gravity. Now the steep ascent of Snæfell commenced. His snowy summit, by an optical illusion, common enough in the mountains, seemed very near, and yet what long hours it took to reach it. Above all, what toil! The stones not being cemented by any earth, nor adhering together by any roots of herbage, rolled away under our feet and rushed down the plain with the speed of an avalanche. In certain places, the sides of the mountain formed an angle of 36 degrees at least with the horizon. It was impossible to climb them, and these stony cliffs had to be rounded, which was no easy matter. We had to assist each other with our sticks. I must say that my uncle kept as close to me as possible. He never let me out of his sight, and many a time his arm was my powerful support. He himself certainly had some inner sense of equilibrium, for he never stumbled. The Icelanders, in spite of their loads, climbed with the agility of mountaineers. To look at the height of Snæfell, it seemed impossible to reach the summit, but after an hour's fatigue and athletic exercise, a sort of staircase suddenly appeared in the midst of the vast carpet of snow lying on the croup of the volcano, and this greatly simplified our ascent. It was formed of one of those torrents of stones ejected by the eruption, and which the Icelanders call Stina. If this torrent had not been arrested in its fall by the formation of the mountainsides, it would have dashed down into the sea, and new islands would have been the result. As it was, it did us good service. The steepness increased, but these stone steps helped us to climb up easily, and indeed so rapidly, that when I stopped for a moment behind the rest, I perceived them already so diminished in size by distance that their appearance was microscopic. At 7 in the evening, we had gone up the 2,000 steps of the stair and risen above an extinct cone of the mountain, a sort of bed on which the actual cone of the crater rested. The sea stretched below us 3,200 feet. We had passed the limit of perpetual snow, which, on account of the humidity of the climate, is rather lower in Iceland. It was bitterly cold. The wind blew violently. I was exhausted. The professor saw that my legs refused to carry me, and in spite of his impatience, he determined to stop. He made a sign to the hunter to that effect, but Hans shook his head and said, "Off and for." "We must go higher, it seems," said my uncle, and asked the reason. "Mistor," replied the guide. "Ja, mistor," repeated one of the Icelanders in a terrified tone. "What does the man mean?" I asked uneasily. "Look," replied my uncle. I gazed down below. An immense column of pulverized pumice, sand, and dust was rising, whirling around like a waterspout. The wind was driving it on the side of Snæfell, to which we were clinging. The thick curtain across the sun projected a great shadow on the mountain. Should this waterspout-like column bend over, it would inevitably catch us in its whirl. This phenomenon, not uncommon when the wind blows from the glaciers, is called in Icelandic mistur. Hastigt, hastigt, cried our guide. Though I was unacquainted with Danish, I understood we were to follow Hans as quickly as possible. He began to go round the cone of the crater, but diagonally, to make the task easier. Before long, the huge column fell on the mountain, which trembled at the shock. The loose stones caught up in its circling eddies flew off in a shower as during an eruption. Fortunately, we had gained the opposite side and were in safety. But without this precaution on the part of our guide, our mangled bodies, reduced to dust, would have been carried away far into the distance, and considered as the product of some unknown meteor. Hans did not think it prudent, though, to pass the night on the sides of the cone. We had to continue our zigzag ascent. The 1,500 feet remaining took us nearly 5 hours to climb. The circuitous windings, the diagonal and counter-marches, measured 3 leagues, I'm sure. I was dead beat, sinking with cold and hunger. The somewhat rarefied atmosphere scarcely allowed my lungs full play, but at length, at 11 p.m, in the dead of the night, the summit of Snæfell was reached, and before seeking shelter in the crater, I had time to see the midnight sun at his lowest point, gilding the sleeping island at my feet with his pale rays. Chapter 16. The supper was quickly dispatched, and the little company housed themselves as best they could. The couch was hard, the shelter rather insufficient, and the situation trying, for we were 5,000 feet above the level of the sea. But in spite of everything, my slumbers this night were particularly peaceful. It was the best sleep I had had for a long time. I did not even dream. Next morning, we awoke half frozen by the keen air. The sun was shining gloriously when I rose from my granite bed and went out to enjoy the magnificent panorama that awaited my gaze. I was on the summit of one of the twin peaks of Snæfell, the southernmost. I commanded a view of almost the whole island. By an optical effect common to all great elevations, the shores looked raised and the center depressed. I could have said that one of Helbesmer's relievo maps lay before me. I saw deep valleys intersecting each other in all directions. Precipices seemed mere walls, lakes changed into ponds, and rivers into little streams. On my right there were glaciers without number, and innumerable peaks, over some of which there was a plume-like cloud of white smoke. The undulating lines of these endless mountains, on which the snow lay like foam, reminded me of a stormy sea. If I turned to the west, there lay old ocean in all his majesty, like a continuation of these foamy summits. I could scarcely tell where the earth ended and the waters began. I was reveling in the magical delight which is awakened in the mind by all great elevations, and this time without giddiness, for at last I had become accustomed to sublime contemplations. My dazzled eyes were bathed in a flood of radiant sunshine. I forgot who I was and where I was, to live the life of elves and sylphs, imaginary beings of the Scandinavian mythology. I gave myself to the luxury of the heights, without a thought of the depths into which I must shortly plunge. But I was recalled to reality by the appearance of the professor and Hans, who rejoined us on the summit. My uncle turned westward and pointed out to me a light vapour, a sort of mist, an appearance of land just above the waves, and said, "That's Greenland." "Greenland?" I cried. "Yes, we are only 35 leagues from it, and when thaws come, the white bears find their way to Iceland on the ice floes from the north. But that's no matter. We are on the top of Snæfell, and here are two peaks, the one to the south, the other to the north. Hans will tell us what the Icelanders call the one we are on at this moment. The question was put, and Hans replied, Skartaris. My uncle glanced at me triumphantly and said, To the crater, then! The crater of Snæfell resembled an inverted cone, the orifice of which was perhaps half a league in diameter. Its depth, I estimated, was about 2,000 feet. Imagine such a reservoir full of thunders and flame. The bottom of the shaft could not measure more than 500 feet in circumference, so that the gentle slope permitted us to get down easily. I involuntarily thought of an enormous wide-mouthed mortar, and the comparison made me shudder. To go down into a mortar, I thought, when it is perhaps loaded and may go off at any moment, is to act like fools. But I could not draw back. Hans, with an air of perfect indifference, took his place at the head of the party. I followed without saying a word. In order to facilitate the descent, Hans pursued a winding track down. He was obliged to go through eruptive rocks, some of which, shaken out of their beds, rushed bounding down the abyss. Their fall awoke echoes of wonderful clearness. Certain parts of the cone form glaciers. Hans would then walk with extreme precaution, sounding the ground at every step with his iron-tipped stick, to discover any crevasses. At doubtful parts, we were fastened together by a long rope, so that anyone who missed his footing would be supported by his companions. This arrangement was prudent, but it did not exclude all danger. However, notwithstanding all the difficulties of the descent, down steeps unknown to the guide, the journey was accomplished without any accident, except the loss of a coil of rope, which fell from the hand of one of the Icelanders and took the quickest road to the bottom of the gulf. At midday, we reached it. I looked up and saw the upper orifice of the cone framing a bit of sky, much reduced in size, but almost perfectly round. Just on the edge appeared the sunny peak of Skartaris, which lost itself in immensity. At the bottom of the crater were three chimneys, out of which, in its eruptions, the central fire of Snæfell had belched out smoke and lava. Each of these chimneys had a diameter of about 100 feet. They gaped at us with wide-open mouths. I had not the courage to look at them, but Professor Liddenbrock had made a rapid survey of all three. He was quite panting, rushing from one to another, gesticulating and talking incoherently. Hans and his companions, seated on blocks of lava, looked wonderingly at this procedure, and evidently thought him mad. All at once my uncle gave a cry. I thought he had lost his footing and was falling into one of the holes. But no, there he was with outstretched arms and legs wide apart, standing in front of a granite rock, laid in the center of the crater like an enormous pedestal, ready to receive a statue of Pluto. He was in the posture of a man who is stupefied, but whose stupefaction will soon give place to the wildest delights. "Axel! Axel!" he cried. "Come, come!" I ran to him. Neither Hans nor his companions moved. "Look!" said the professor. And sharing at least his stupefaction, if not his joy, I read on the western face of the block, in runic characters half eaten away by time, the thrice-accursed name. "Arne Saknussemm," cried my uncle. "Do you still doubt?" I made no reply, but went back to my seat in consternation. This evidence crushed me. How long I sat lost in my own reflections, I cannot say. All I know is that when I looked up again, only Hans and my uncle were in the crater. The Icelanders had taken their leave, and were now on their way down the side of Snarfell, back to Stapi. Hans was sleeping quietly at the foot of a rock, in a stream of lava, where he had improvised a bed for himself. My uncle was pacing about like a wild beast in a trapper's pit. I had neither the wish nor the power to rise, and following the guide's example, I fell into a troubled sleep, fancying I could hear the noises and feel the tremblings of the mountain. Thus passed the first night in the bottom of the crater. Next day, a grey, gloomy, heavy sky overshadowed the mouth of the cone. I did not know it so much by the obscurity of the gulf as by my uncle's rage over it. I understood the reason, and a ray of hope dawned on me. This was why. Of the three routes open to us, only one had been followed by Saknussemm, and according to the learned Icelander, it was to be recognized by the particular fact mentioned in the cryptogram, that the shadow of Skartaris would come and fall softly over the edge of it during the last days of June. That sharp peak might, in fact, be considered as the gnomon, or pin, of an immense sundial, whose shadow on a given day would point out the road to the earth's center. Now, no sun, no shadow, and consequently, no indication. It was the 25th of June now, and should the sky remain overcast 4 days longer, our observations would have to be deferred till another year. I cannot attempt to depict the wrath of Professor Liddenbrock. The day passed and no shadow appeared. Hans never stirred, though he must have asked himself what we were waiting for, if indeed he could ask himself anything at all. My uncle never once addressed me, but kept his eyes fixed on the gloomy sky. On the 26th, there was still nothing. Rain mingled with snow kept falling all day long. Hans made a hut of pieces of lava. I rather enjoyed watching the thousands of cascades that came rushing down the sides of the cone, the deafening noise increasing at every stone they came against. My uncle was beside himself with passion, and certainly it was enough to irritate a far more patient man than he. It was like foundering within sight of the harbour. But heaven never sends great sorrow without great joy, and there was satisfaction in store for Professor Liddenbrock to compensate for his agonizing suspense. The next day was again overcast, but on Sunday, the 28th of June, the last day but two of the month, with the change of moon came the change of weather. The sun poured a flood of rays into the crater. Every hillock, each rock and stone, every projection had its share in this affluence of light, and threw its shadow forthwith on the ground. Amongst the others was the shadow of Skartaris, which lay like a sharp peak, and it began to move round insensibly with the radiant orb. My uncle moved with it. At noon, when it was at its least, it fell softly on the edge of the middle chimney. "It is there! It is there!" exclaimed the professor, adding in Danish, "Now let's away to the center of the globe!" I looked at Hans. "Forut," was his quiet reply. "Forward," returned my uncle. It was 1:13. Chapter 17. The real journey now commenced. Hitherto, our fatigues had been more than our difficulties, but now the latter would multiply at every step. I had not yet even looked down the bottomless well in which I was about to be engulfed. The moment had come. I must now take my part in the enterprise, or refuse the risk. But I was ashamed to draw back before the hunter, and Hans accepted the adventure so coolly, with such indifference, and such a perfect disregard of danger, that I blushed at the idea of being less brave than he. Had we been alone, I should have renewed my arguments, but in the presence of the guide, I kept silent. Memory recalled for an instant my pretty Firlandaise, and I approached the central chimney. I have already said that it measured 100 feet in diameter and 300 feet in circumference. Holding on by a jutting rock, I looked down into it. My hair stood on end. The feeling of vacuity took possession of my being. I felt my center of gravity becoming displaced, and my head began to reel as if I were intoxicated. There is nothing stranger than this abyss attraction. I was about to fall in when a powerful hand held me back. It was that of Hans. Evidently, I had not taken enough abyss lessons at the Frelseskirk in Copenhagen. But short as my survey had been of this well, I had a good idea of its conformation. Its walls, which were nearly perpendicular, were thick with sharp projections, which would greatly facilitate descent. But if the staircase was there, the rail was wanting. A rope fastened to the edge of the orifice would have been sufficient support. But how could we unfasten it when we reached the lower extremity? My uncle employed a very simple method to obviate this great difficulty. He undid a coil of rope, about the thickness of a finger, and 400 feet long. He let half of it slip down first. Then he rolled it round a block of lava, which jutted out, and threw down the other half. Each of us could then descend by holding both lines of rope in his hand, which could not get loose. When he had gone 200 feet, nothing could be easier than to haul the rope in by pulling one end. Then the exercise would begin again, and go on ad infinitum. "Now," said my uncle, after these preparations were completed, "let's see about the luggage. We will divide it into 3 parts, and each of us will strap one on his back. Of course, I mean only fragile articles." The daring man evidently did not include us in the category. "Hans," he said, "will take charge of the tools and a portion of the provisions. You, Axel, will take another third of the provisions and the arms, and I will take the rest of the provisions and the delicate instruments." "But who is to take the clothes," said I, "and that heap of ropes and ladders?" "They will take care of themselves." "How?" "You'll see." My uncle liked to employ grand means. He ordered Hans to make a bundle of all the non-fragile articles, which was then firmly roped and thrown right down into the abyss. I could hear the loud roaring noise it made in whizzing through the air, and my uncle stooped down and watched its progress till it was out of sight. Then my uncle said, "That's all right. Now it is our turn." I ask any sane man if it was possible to hear these words without a shudder. The professor forthwith fastened the package of instruments on his back, and Hans took the tools and I the arms. The descent commenced in the following order. Hans first, then my uncle, then myself. It was made in complete silence, only broken by the fall of fragments of rock into the abyss. I let myself drop, as it were, frantically clutching the double cord in one hand and propping myself with my stick with the other. One idea possessed me. I was afraid the support would give way. The cord seemed to me so frail to bear the weight of 3 persons. I hung upon it as little as possible, performing wonderful feats of equilibrium upon the projections of lava which my feet sought to catch hold of like a hand. Whenever one of these slipping steps shook beneath Hans's foot, he said in his quiet voice, "Gefacht." "Attention," repeated my uncle. In about 30 minutes, we found ourselves on the slab of a rock that was firmly embedded in the wall of the chimney. Hans pulled the rope by one end, and the other rose in the air. After passing the upper rock, it fell down again, and a shower of stones and lava came rattling after it, like rain, or dangerous hail, rather. Leaning down over the edge of our narrow plateau, I noticed that the bottom of the hole was still invisible. Then the rope maneuver began again, and half an hour afterwards we had gone another 200 feet. I don't know whether the maddest geologist would have attempted to study, during his descent, the nature of the rocks through which he passed. For my own part, I didn't trouble myself about it. I didn't care whether they were Pliocene, Miocene, Eocene, Cretaceous, Jurassic, Triassic, Permian, Carboniferous, Devonian, Silurian, or Primitive. But no doubt the professor was taking observations or making notes, for he said to me, "The farther I go, the more confident I feel. The disposition of these volcanic formations strongly supports the theory of Humphrey Davy. We are now among the primitive rocks, on which the chemical operation took place, produced by the contact of metals with air and water. I reject absolutely the theory of a central heat. However, we shall soon see." Always the same conclusion. I was not inclined to amuse myself by arguing, and he took my silence for agreement. The descent began afresh, but at the end of 3 hours I could not yet catch a glimpse of the bottom. When I looked up, I perceived the orifice narrowing sensibly. The sides seemed to approach each other, and it was gradually getting dark. Still we went on, down, down. I fancied the loosened stones fell quicker to the bottom, and with more noise. I had taken care to keep an exact account of our manoeuvres with the ropes, so that I knew exactly the depth attained and the time elapsed. Each descent occupied half an hour, and we had made 14. I calculated then that we had been 7 hours and 3 hours and a half extra for rest and meals, as we had allowed us a quarter of an hour between each manoeuvre. Altogether, 10 hours and a half. We had started at 1. It must therefore now be 11. As to the depth, 14 times 200 feet gave a depth of 2,800 feet. At this moment I heard the voice of Hans calling, "Halt!" I stopped instantly, just in time to keep my feet from knocking my uncle's head. "We are there," he cried. "Where?" said I, slipping down beside him. "At the bottom of the perpendicular shaft."
"Then there is no outlet?"
"Yes, there is a passage, I think, to the right. I only caught a glimpse of it, but we shall see tomorrow. We'll sup now, and then go to sleep."
The darkness was not yet complete. We opened the bag of provisions and took some food, and then we all three settled ourselves for the night, as comfortably as we could, on the stones and fragments of lava. As I lay on my back, I chanced to open my eyes, and perceived a bright spot at the extremity of the tube, 3,000 feet long, transformed now into a gigantic telescope. It was a star, but deprived of all scintillation by the distance. By my reckoning, it was Beta Ursa Minor. Then I fell fast asleep. Chapter 18. At 8 next morning, a ray of daylight came to awaken us. The myriad facets on the lava walls received it and threw it back in a shower of sparks. This light was strong enough to enable us to discern surrounding objects.
"Well now, Axel, what do you say to it?" cried my uncle, rubbing his hands. "Did you ever pass a quieter night in the old house in Königstrasse? No noise of carts or street cries, no boatmen's vociferations?"
"Certainly we are quiet enough, but the very calm has something terrifying about it."
"Now, now!" cried my uncle. "If you are frightened already, how will you get on by and by? We haven't gone 1 inch yet into the bowels of the earth."
"What do you mean?"
I mean that we have only reached the level of the island. This long vertical tube which opens in the crater of Snæfell ends almost at the level of the sea.
Are you sure of that?
Quite sure. Consult the barometer.
I found the mercury, which had risen gradually in the instrument, in proportion as we descended, had stopped at 29 inches.
You see, continued the professor, we have only yet the pressure of the atmosphere, and I am impatient for the manometer to replace the barometer.
The barometer, in fact, would become useless from the moment the weight of the air should exceed the pressure at the level of the sea.
But, said I, isn't there reason to fear that this always increasing pressure will be very painful?
No! We shall descend slowly, and our lungs will get accustomed to the denser air.
Aeronauts end by having too little air, as they rise constantly higher, and we shall have too much, perhaps, but I prefer that. Don't let us lose an instant. Where is the bundle we rolled down before us?
This reminded me that we had looked for it the night before and could not find it. My uncle asked Hans about it, who, after gazing round with the keen eye of a hunter, replied,
"Der Hooper."
"Up there." Sure enough, there was the bundle, hanging on a rocky projection 100 feet above our head. The agile Icelander climbed up after it like a cat, and in a few minutes the bundle was in our possession again.
"Now," said my uncle, "let us breakfast, and eat like men who are likely to have a long day's walk before them."
The biscuit and extract of beef were washed down with a drink of water mixed with a little gin. After breakfast, my uncle drew a notebook out of his pocket for observations. Then he took up his different instruments and wrote down the following result.
Monday, June 29th. Chronometer, 8:17 a.m. Barometer, 29 feet 7 inches. Thermometer, 6 degrees. Direction, east-southeast.
This last observation applied to the dim passage and was indicated by the compass.
"Now, Axel," exclaimed the professor enthusiastically, "we are actually going to push our way into the heart of the earth. This is the exact time when our journey commences."
So saying, my uncle took up the apparatus of Ruhmkorff, suspended from his neck, with one hand, and with the other placed it in communication with the electric coil in the lantern, and immediately a light was produced, bright enough to illumine the dark passage. Hans carried the other apparatus, which was also set in action. This ingenious application of electricity would enable us to go on for a long time, creating an artificial day, safe even in the midst of the most inflammable gases.
"Forward," said my uncle.
Each one resumed his load. Hans undertook to push the bundle of ropes and clothing before him along the ground, and I came behind him into the gallery. Just as I was about to enter the gloomy passage, I looked up through the distant aperture and saw once more the sky of Iceland, which I should never gaze upon again. At the time of the last eruption in 1229, the lava had forced this passage for itself, and the sides of it were covered with a thick, shiny coating of it, which reflected and intensified the electric light. The great difficulty of the route was to avoid slipping too rapidly down an incline of 45 degrees. Happily, certain erosions and protuberances served for steps, which we descended, letting our luggage slip before us from the end of a long rope. But what were steps under our feet became stalactites in every other part. The lava, which was porous in certain places, was covered with small rounded blisters, crystals of opaque quartz, adorned with clear drops of glass, and suspended from the roof like chandeliers, which seemed to light up as we passed. It looked as if the genii of the abyss were illuminating their palace for the reception of their terrestrial visitants.
"It is magnificent!" I exclaimed involuntarily. "What a sight, Uncle! Don't you admire all those shades of lava from reddish-brown to bright yellow, and those crystals looking like luminous globes?"
"Ah, you like that, Axel," replied my uncle. "You call that splendid, my boy. We will see many of those, I hope. Let us walk on."
He would have been more correct if he had said slide, for we let ourselves slip without effort down the steep inclines. It was the Facilis Descensus Averni of Virgil. The compass, which I consulted frequently, indicated the southeast with undeviating regularity. This stream of lava neither turned aside to the east nor west. It had the inflexibility of the straight line. However, there was no sensible increase of heat. This supported the theories of Davy, and more than once I was astonished when I consulted the thermometer. 2 hours after, it only marked 10 degrees, that is to say, an increase of 4 degrees. This authorized me to suppose that our descent was more horizontal than vertical. The depth reached might have been easily ascertained, as the professor measured with exactitude the angles of deviation and inclination on the road, but he kept his observations to himself. About 8 p.m., he gave the signal to stop. Hans sat down immediately. The lamps were hung up to a jutting piece of lava. We were in a sort of cavern, but the air was not deficient. Quite the contrary. Certain puffs of it even reached us. What had produced them? To what atmospheric disturbance must we attribute their origin? I did not care just now to pursue the subject, however. I was too hungry and tired to argue the question. A 7 hours' descent involves considerable expenditure of strength. I was exhausted and rejoiced to hear the word halt. Hans spread provisions for us upon a block of lava, and we all ate heartily. One thing, however, made me uneasy. Our supply of water was half consumed. My uncle reckoned on replenishing it from subterranean springs, but hitherto not even one had appeared. I could not help drawing his attention to this fact.
"And are you surprised at seeing no springs?" he replied.
"Most certainly. And what's more, I'm very uneasy. We only have water enough for 5 days."
"Don't worry yourself, Axel. I'll answer for it. We shall find water, and more than we want."
"And when?"
"When we get out of this lava that envelops us. How can you think springs could burst through such walls as these?"
"But perhaps this passage runs to a great depth. It seems to me that we have not made great progress vertically."
"What makes you think that?"
"Because the heat would be much greater if we had penetrated very far through the crust."
"According to your system," replied my uncle, "what is the thermometer?"
"Scarcely 15 degrees, which shows only an increase of 9 degrees since we started."
"Well, and what is your conclusion?"
"This is my conclusion. According to the most exact observations, the increase of heat in the interior of the globe is 1 degree in 100 feet. But certain localities may modify this figure. For instance, at Yakutsk in Siberia, the increase is 1 degree in 36 feet. This difference evidently depends on the conducting power of rocks. I may add, too, that in the neighborhood of an extinct volcano and through gneiss, it has been observed that the elevation of the temperature was only 1 degree in 125 feet. Let us adopt this last hypothesis and calculate."
"Do so, my boy."
"Nothing is easier," I said, writing down the figures in my notebook. 9 times 125 feet make 1,125 feet of depth."
"That's it, exactly."
"Well, then?"
"Well,
According to my observations, we are 10,000 feet below the level of the sea.
Is it possible?
Yes. Or figures are no longer figures. The professor's calculations were exact. We had already exceeded by 6,000 feet the greatest depth ever reached by man, such as the mines of Kitzbühel in the Tyrol and those of Wüttenborg in Bohemia. The temperature, which ought to have been 81 degrees, was scarcely 15 degrees. This was certainly well worth thinking over.
Chapter 19. Next day, Tuesday, June the 30th, at 6 a.m., the descent